heard it. Yeah, it was very, very loud. And you could feel it. Feel it on the ground.
Alaskans described the explosions at the end of the Boston Marathon. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the governor's oil tax overhaul passes the legislature despite the objections of Democrats.
I'm very concerned that this bill may bankrupt the state. I know in my heart this will lead to an income tax.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Several Alaskans were near the finish line of the Boston Marathon when two bombs exploded in the crowded finish area. No Alaskans are known to be among the three people who were killed and the more than 100 others who were injured. Identifications, however, of those victims have not yet been released. 41 Alaskans were registered to run the race today, and many had family members there to cheer them on. Anchorage resident Heather Afton finished the race about 15 minutes before the bombs exploded. She was just a few blocks away when she heard the two explosions.
Right away, I knew something was wrong. It was that kind of sound where you knew it was big, and I instantly knew something was wrong. I thought of 9/11.
Afton says it was a dream of hers to qualify for the Boston Marathon, which only allows runners with fast marathon times to enter. She says for 15 minutes after she finished, she felt elation. But everything changed the instant the first bomb went off.
My trip down those 26 miles was just one long party, and so many people put everything they had into it today, and it just is so heartbreaking, and I guess because of that, I'm just feeling anger and rage at the whole thing that was tainted.
Kodiak resident Howard Valley, who is 64 years old, finished his race roughly 40 minutes before the blasts and said he was walking away from the area when he heard the explosions.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't like a propane tank or anything like that going off the, you know, Kodiak at times, or anything else. So it was quite obviously a large explosion of some type. But I didn't know what it was until maybe about half an hour later when I got inside a hotel and was watching the TV.
Valley has safely returned to the bed and breakfast he is staying at Newton, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston. He said it took him about 4 hours to get out of the city. He had to use alternate train and bus routes because transportation was shut down near the race course. Anchorage resident Hetty Aishai didn't run the race herself, but she was waiting with a friend for her husband at the family meeting area when the explosions happened.
And I kind of looked at my friend Jonathan, and he looked at me, and I looked up at the sky, and he's like, I hope that was thunder. And we looked at each other, and we knew it wasn't. And then we heard another one, and he said, I don't think that's thunder, Hetty. So we heard it. Yeah, it was very, very loud. And you could feel it. You could feel it on the ground.
It took Aishai about 10 minutes to reunite with her husband, Ted, who lives in Wisconsin. He was looking toward the finish when the explosions happened, and he saw smoke. It was his second Boston Marathon, and he says it's a wonderful event.
Thousands and thousands of Bostonians come out to watch it, and you have runners from all around the world here. So I'm sad for the marathon because, you know, this was a 117th running, and it puts a damper on really a wonderful tradition.
Aishide says his thoughts are with the victims. He says despite the horror of today's marathon, he would run the race again. For the first time since 2010, the Alaska State Legislature has wrapped up in 90 days. With Republican majorities in both chambers, they pass legislation big and small. They advanced an in-state gas line project and also put together a financing program to truck natural gas from the North Slope to the interior. But the most important piece of legislation they passed was a bill cutting oil taxes. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that it's a priority that Governor Sean Parnell has fought for throughout his administration.
Sunday was a good day for Governor Sean Parnell. For years, he's pushed for lower taxes on oil companies only to be blocked by a bipartisan coalition in the Senate. This legislature, things were going to be different. That coalition had been obliterated after a number of members lost their seats in the wake of redistricting. Now, Republicans had control of both chambers. This weekend, Parnell finally got to watch lawmakers pass a plan that he says will put more oil in the pipeline.
We're in a place now where we are competitive by every measure from independent experts. Therefore, we ought to have some new investment and new production for our people.
The final vote on Parnell's legislation came from the Senate just hours before the legislature was scheduled to gavel out. The bill essentially scraps the current tax regime known as ACEs. Senator Anna Faircloth, an Eagle River Republican, carried the bill. She argued that the tax cut would encourage more investment and more oil production in the state.
I'd say it's a step forward in doing what's right for our kids and for the next generation.
While a dozen senators voted for it, Faircloth was one of just two who spoke in favor of the oil tax change. The votes had already been counted, so the floor session gave those against the bill, like Anchorage Democrat Hollis French, a space to offer their swan songs for the present tax structure.
I'm very concerned that this bill may bankrupt the state. I know in my heart this will lead to an income tax. I know in my heart this will lead to the loss of our permanent fund dividend. Okay. I know for a fact that's beyond contention this will lead to greater profits for the oil industry.
A number of the opponents used fiscal responsibility as a reason for fighting the bill. The bill creates a tax ceiling of 35%, which is offset by a per barrel credit that shrinks as the price of oil goes up. At forecasted prices and rates of production, the Department of Revenue expects the bill to lower taxes by at least $3.5 billion over the next 5 years. Some legislators suggested that the price tag would be even greater. Senator Bert Stedman, a Sitka Republican, pointed to an analysis determining that the state would have lost $2 billion if the new tax rules were applied to just last year's production in Prudhoe and Kuparik. Bill opponents also rebutted arguments that oil production would go up if Alaska competed with states with lower tax rates, like North Dakota and Texas. They said that Alaska's production decline began well before ACEs was implemented. They said it's technology, not taxes, that's causing the boom in shale-rich states. And they characterized anecdotes that oil industry workers were leaving Alaska as misleading. Anchorage Democrat Bill Bilikowski noted that the number of oil industry jobs was at an all-time high, according to the Department of Labor.
Companies are not fleeing Alaska. Jobs are not fleeing Alaska. Investment's not fleeing Alaska. Those facts are provably wrong.
In response, Faircloth described those figures as inflated. She argued that Alaska has a distorted view of the North Slope economy because companies can earn tax credits through capital expenditures. Those credits let them buy down the tax rate by putting more money into Alaskan oil fields. The bill that passed on Sunday removes them.
The industry has figured out that the best thing that they can do with their money is spend money, and it'll reduce the tax rates that they pay on the North Slope.
The bill ultimately passed 12-8, with Democrat Donnie Olson of Golovin joining a block of Republicans. Coastal Republicans Bert Stedman and Gary Stevens voted no, along with the rest of the Democrats. The new tax system will go into effect in 2014. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The legislature also approved a $2.2 billion capital budget this weekend. It was expected to be a vehicle for a comprehensive multi-year education package that was frequently discussed by leadership, but that package never showed up. Some controversial legislation was also dropped in the final days, with action delayed until next year. The House hit the brakes on a bill that would limit Medicaid funding for abortion after it passed the Senate. The Senate kept a bill that would advance the Kinnick Arm Bridge project in committee after the House decided to hand control of the proposal off to the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation in the wake of a damning audit. But with a total of 71 bills passed, this legislature moved nearly twice as many bills as the previous one did over the first session. There will likely be a petition drive to reverse the new oil tax bill passed by the legislature last night. A number of the people who campaigned against Senate Bill 21 had a strategy meeting today at Democratic Party headquarters. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
It has apparently been planned for a while. Longtime activist Ray Metcalf was busy putting out a mass email within hours of the passage of the oil tax bill. It contained a copy of the bill and an application to be a sponsor of a petition drive for what he calls a referendum to repeal it. A noon meeting took place around a large conference room table with a teleconference phone. The door would be opened with each new visitor, but any members of the press were shooed away. Through the noon hour, a flow of activists continued to show up and join the session. Among them was Vic Fisher, one of the authors of the state constitution. A quarrel over the constitutionality of a petition drive to repeal a bill involving the legislative power of appropriation is likely. Also in the room was longtime oil industry analyst Jack Roderick and Malcolm Roberts, who headed up the organization Backbone's campaign against the oil tax bill, which ended up passing the Senate unchanged from the House substitute. The organizers of the petition drive will first need 100 sponsors, and then, if they get by the Attorney General and the Lieutenant Governor, they will have 90 days to try to get 31,000 valid signatures in order to get the repeal on the ballot. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Joe Miller explores a run for Begich's Senate seat.
Some people sent me notes after Joe announces the exploratory committee is saying that's the best gift Begich could have got.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
2010 Senate candidate Joe Miller says he's exploring another Senate run. This time, he's eyeing the seat held by Democrat Mark Begich. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, Miller is taking the first step to formally announcing his bid for a race that's more than a year and a half away.
Alaska has not reelected a Democrat to the Senate since Mike Gravel in 1974. So the stakes are high for the Democratic Party and Senator Begich. He raised $948,000 in the first quarter of this year, and he's sitting on more than $1.5 million in campaign cash. So whoever wins the Republican primary will face a formidable incumbent. Miller announced late Sunday in a blog post he's forming an exploratory committee that allows him to raise money for the campaign and test the waters. It's not an official entrance. And he's not the first to dip his toes.
We have to remember that the goal that Republicans have is replacing Mark Begich.
Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell, who announced his exploratory committee earlier this year, says Miller called him Sunday to tell him the news. Treadwell says he expected Miller to jump into the race, and while primaries are important to select the strongest candidate, he's worried a protracted one could leave Senator Begich in a better position.
Some people sent me notes after Joe announces the exploratory committee is saying that's the best gift Begich could have got. I don't know.
Treadwell says he does not know when he'll make a final decision, but he says polls have shown him leading Miller and competing well with Begich. He did not say who paid for and conducted the polls. Treadwell will be in D.C. this week. He says he'll be meeting with congressional leaders, but he would not say whether he's meeting with the National Republican Senatorial Committee. That's the wing of the GOP tasked with winning more seats in the Senate. Jennifer Duffy is a senior editor with the nonpartisan Cook Political Report. She says Miller's move is no surprise, and she expects a more crowded primary field. She says Miller will soon learn that being a candidate today is different than in 2010.
He was a Tea Party candidate in the first cycle that Tea Party candidates really came to the fore in Senate races, and they had the element of surprise helping them. And that is not the case this time.
That, Duffy says, means Miller's opponents will try and define just who he is during the primary. Miller will have to defend his past actions and statements, something he didn't have to do much of in 2010. A spokesperson with the NRSC says it's too soon to support any one candidate. Miller met with the head of that group earlier this year. Duffy says the NRSC has backed off supporting candidates in primary campaigns, and she expects the same unless Governor Sean Parnell joins the race. With Miller, Duffy says, the NRSC has learned its lesson.
My sense is that the experience they had with Joe Miller in 2010 would probably lead them not to embrace his candidacy so quickly.
In his announcement, Miller says the 2014 race is not just about beating Mark Begich. It's about saving the country. His rhetoric and often incendiary language has drawn the scorn of many mainstream Republicans. Neither Miller nor his 2010 foe, Senator Lisa Murkowski, would comment for this story, but Senator Mark Begich would. Senator Begich, who styles himself an independent on his campaign site, says he takes any candidate seriously. He would not say whether he'd prefer to face Miller or Treadwell.
Whoever, you know, whoever the Republican Party decides to anoint over there is their decision.
The GOP primary is not until August 2014, 3 months before the winner of that race will face Senator Begich in the general election. In Anchorage, I'm Peter Granitz.
Over the weekend, the Anchorage Municipal Clerk's Office released updated numbers for the April 2nd municipal election, including for the close race in West Anchorage's District 3. By Saturday evening, Ernie Hall had widened the gap between he and the write-ins, leading by more than 300 votes. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Two things happened over the weekend. Question and absentee ballots were run through an AccuVote machine and added to election night totals. In addition, the clerk's office conducted a hand count of West Anchorage's District 3, where Hall led Moe by just 93 votes on election night.
Write-in, Nick Moe. Oval is not marked, no count.
Challenge.
That's Municipal Next Clerk Barbara Jones reading right through in. Ballots during the hand count, and Moe's attorney Patrick Munson challenging her decision to throw the vote out. Due to the ballot scan through the machine, Ernie Hall now has 4,296 votes, and there are 3,878 write-in votes. Hall now has a 318-vote lead. Exactly how many of those write-in votes belong to write-in candidate Moe won't be known until the clerk's office releases the results of a hand count sometime this week. During the hand count, election workers divided the ballots into several categories. The category that the Moe campaign is most interested in is this one. Anchorage Deputy Clerk of Elections Amanda Moser explains.
There was instances where a write-in candidate was written and no oval marked. And those came out as challenges within the review today. And so none of this information shows up in the election summary report.
In other words, they weren't counted. The situation harkens back to the Lisa Murkowski write-in campaign. In 2010, an Alaska Supreme Court decision said that voters had to mark the oval in some fashion in order for a vote to count. Besides the oval not being filled in, there were misspellings of Moe's name, among other anomalies that the municipal attorney, Dennis Wheeler, advised the clerk's office wouldn't be accepted. How many challenged ballots there are could determine whether the Moe campaign decides to pursue a legal challenge. Regardless of how things turn out, Moe says he's proud of what his campaign has accomplished in such a short period of time.
I still think this campaign made history. One of the most successful write-in campaigns in our city's election history. You know, I'm very proud of what we're able to accomplish.
Moe says his campaign is doing an analysis of the challenged ballots and will soon decide what their next steps may be. Results from the hand count conducted Saturday are set to be released by the clerk's office early this week. The election results could be certified at Tuesday's assembly meeting. Ernie Hall was contacted for this story but didn't return phone calls by deadline. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Do you own a business or manage employees? Research shows that employees who feel supported at work with their parenting challenges are more loyal and productive. When you let employees know they can attend a teacher conference, stay at home with a sick child, or adjust their schedule to secure quality childcare, you contribute to stronger families. That's Strengthening Families Alaska Style. This message is sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust, THRED, and Best Beginnings. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Grade school archers in Bethel will soon be competing nationally. After winning at state competition, they have qualified for the National Archers in School program in Louisville, Kentucky next month. KYUK's Sophie Ivan has more.
Five students from the Gladys Jung Elementary School will represent Alaska as champion archers. One of them is sixth grader Riley Johnson.
It went pretty good. I was really nervous, though. I was shaking.
At state, Riley shot 246 points out of 300. Her father is the archery coach, Rafe Johnson.
Fourth graders all the way up to 12th graders shoot the same bow.
Johnson says the team didn't have to travel in order to compete at the state tournament.
The cool thing is it's virtual, is they want an honest archer. So what we do is we shoot our tournaments in our own gyms. We submit our scores online.
The national competition, however, will not be virtual.
They will be shooting live against 9,000 other kids.
The Gladys Jung Archery Program started 4 years ago, and the young archers have made state every year. They practice twice a week, shooting a target that's about 2 feet across from a distance of 10 to 15 meters, or what is about 30 and 50 feet. Johnson says they train for 3 weeks before they are even allowed to pick up a bow and arrow.
It's all technique. Where to put their feet, how to place their hands on the bow, how to properly knock an arrow, being safe. The training is not physical. It's more mental and procedural.
Sixth grader and nationals qualifier Gareth Rice explains a crucial technique.
And if you're left hand dominant, you shoot pulling the string with your left hand. If you're right eye dominant, you pull the string with your right hand.
Gareth shot 262 points out of 300. The other state champions are fourth grader Rowan Hartman, fifth grader Simon Snow, and sixth grader Darren Caballos. In Bethel, I'm Sophie Ivan.
When many of us imagine a typical Alaskan Native elder, we may think of an older person living in a bush village or perhaps a hub community like Bethel, Barrow, or Wrangell. But while that situation may still be true for the majority of elders, increasing numbers are following their families to Alaska's cities. In this report, Len Anderson looks at urban elders.
According to the 2010 census, the municipality of Anchorage has slightly over 23,000 residents of all ages identifying themselves as Alaska Native or American Indian. That tally includes a sizable number of elders. Elizabeth Medicine Crow is president and CEO of First Alaskans. First Alaskans organizes the annual Elder and Youth Conference, which immediately precedes the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention held in October. Medicine Crow says the urban relocation gives elders an altered but still important role. Now many not only pass on cultural knowledge, but help bridge geographical divides.
Our elder keynotes, Sam and Carrie Herman from Aquariuk, they've actually lived in Anchorage for, years. But because they are stewards of their culture, they carry that with them no matter where they are. That's not place-based. That's not only geographic-based. It's who they are.
Medicine Crow says that self-identification pattern is crucial for younger natives.
When I introduce myself and the role that I have with the organization, I'm from Kihuan. I work in Anchorage. And I know lots of other Alaska Native people who are across the state or even back in D.C., their frame of reference is this is who I am and where I'm from. I just happen to be living here right now.
To cultivate this sense of identification among the youngest generation in Anchorage, the school district has the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School, which has seen robust enrollment and academic success. It also has the school within a school for Native students at East High, as well as the district-wide Native Youth Olympics. The Alaska Native Heritage Center offers Native youth several programs where elders teach traditional skills, especially important to young people without an elder family member nearby.
My grandparents enriched my life. I was lucky to always live like 5 minutes from them.
Andrea Van Ravensway sits at a family gathering in her parents' Northeast Anchorage home. About 25 years ago, doctors advised her grandmother, Norma Gregg, to move from Kotzebue to Anchorage, where she could receive dialysis treatment.
My parents moved down after she moved down, and then everybody moved down, all our aunts and uncles, and they're still here, even though my gram's not here anymore. She was like the nucleus of the family. Everyone was always at her house in Kotzebue. Then when she moved here, it took a couple years. Even here in Anchorage, she was the center of the swarm.
If Anchorage made it difficult for her grandfather, Ben, to teach some traditional Arctic hunting and fishing skills, he had other offerings.
We hear lots of stories about our family and his parents and my cousins about when they were babies and how they were as babies. And yeah, he's still a storyteller.
Her grandmother died in 2000. Andrea's grandfather still lives nearby, but he's 86, and the family's Anchorage Center has passed to a younger generation of elders, her parents, Ted and Linda Davidovics. Linda is Norma and Ben's daughter.
Whenever we all went to their place, they really spoiled us. We didn't realize how spoiled we were. The home was always open, and now we have to do that. It's our turn.
Andrea's two children, one preschool and the other a Bartlett High freshman, are present. The little one is playing. The older listens to her mother and grandmother.
Anybody can stop by anytime they want to. And if they're hungry, they can come over and eat. They want to just sit back and relax, and they can come over, and they're always welcome in our home.
Linda Davidovics then asks if everyone has had enough to eat. After all, we have plenty more. For Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matt Miller in Juneau, Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak, Dacia Eaton and Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Sophie Ivan in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Peter Granitz and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Register now for the 2013 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, May 2nd and 3rd at the Dena Center in Anchorage. This fifth annual conference offers participants an unmatched opportunity to network with national industry experts and learn the latest on policies, programs, and projects in the clean energy industry. Online registration ends on April 26th. More information at www.bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP, your voice for renewable energy.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.